The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Riley, Judge Sleater, Judge Bryan, the Honorable Denise Riley presiding. Now calling the case of State versus Thompson, 820-1232.
Thank you and good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I know that you both are familiar with how this works. You'll each have 15 minutes with 5 minutes for rebuttal for appellant. And when you begin your argument, please state your name for the record. This is being recorded. With that, Mr. Erickson.
Good morning and may it please the court. My name is Anders Erickson and I represent the appellant this morning, Nicholas Thompson. After a contested competency hearing, the district court found Mr. Thompson not competent to stand trial and suspended the district court proceedings. The court based its decision solely on a finding that Mr. Thompson was not able to rationally consult with his attorneys. Mr. Thompson is requesting that this court reverse the district court's order and find him competent to stand trial for two reasons. First, because Mr. Thompson validly and therefore competently waived his right to counsel prior to the competency hearing, and then competently represented himself at the hearing, Mr. Thompson should have been given the opportunity to represent himself pro se at trial. In other words, any inability to rationally consult with counsel should not have precluded Mr. Thompson from proceeding to trial because Mr. Thompson was competent to stand trial without counsel.
Mr. Erickson, if I can jump in, what is the standard under the U.S. Supreme Court jurisprudence for waiving a constitutional right?
As far as whether it's knowing, voluntary, and intelligent?
Well, I think there's a distinction that most people make between knowing, voluntary, intelligent, and what I think of as capacity. Some might think of that as part of intelligence or knowingly, but I think that the case law distinguishes it, calls it competence. So that's what I'm asking. What's the standard for competency that a court must follow in order to then determine that this person is competent to waive a constitutional right?
Yeah, I think under Gonines v. Morin and then also Camacho, which is Minnesota Supreme Court case, I believe it's the same competency standard that we look at when we're determining whether a defendant is competent to proceed to trial.
And then my question becomes, because I agree with you, it's that same two-part test that seems like the test for any constitutional right. To be competent to waive that, you have to satisfy that test. So then my question becomes, where in the district court's order does the district court discuss the test that it used to determine competency when it deemed Thompson competent to waive counsel? Where in the order or the transcript does the district court discuss the test used?
At that stage,
not the competency stage, at the waiver stage, because you have to be competent to waive right first. So what's the standard that was applied by the district court when it deemed Thompson competent to waive counsel?
It's an interesting question because the judge did consider whether he knew what was going to be taking place at the hearing, whether he discussed what was going to take place at the hearing with his attorney. The judge then asked the attorney, did you consult with him? And he said, yes, I consulted with Mr. Thompson and he knew what was going to be happening at the hearing. He had a rational understanding what was going to be going on at the hearing. So no, the judge didn't go through exactly what the Supreme Court articulated that should happen. But the court also said in its order that it contemplated the idea of somebody who potentially is incompetent representing themselves at a hearing and then found that he validly waived his right to counsel.
Right. And it seems to me that the problem is we have a standard or a test for competency, and I'm looking to see the district court apply that test. And I'm having a little bit of trouble seeing where the district court applied the part of the test that considers someone who's rationally able to consult with their attorney in determining competency to waive counsel. I'm having a little bit of hard time seeing where the district court actually considered and applied that part of the test when it deemed Thompson competent to waive counsel. Can you help me there?
Mr. Erickson, can I follow up on Judge Bryan's questions? Because it's something that we've been discussing getting ready for this hearing. As I read your request, the remedy you're seeking is for this court to find your client competent. You are not asking us to send it back for a competency hearing with an attorney. In other words, are you claiming that the district court erred, or do you want us to consider this issue, that the district court erred when it presented or permitted your client to represent himself at his competency hearing?
No, Your Honor. And I think
actually,
that
if I could follow up too, because the whether, you know, before you, there's a lot to unpack. So if there's a way for, if we are to permitted to look at this, that depends on what kind of error it is. So in answering this question, I hope you'll keep in mind whether something is a structural error or some other type of error. Because if it's a structural error, then obviously it should be something that this court could look into, right?
Well, there's a handful of things to respond to there. First, our position is that Mr. Thompson is competent to proceed to trial. Our position is that because he was competent to waive counsel, that therefore he was competent to proceed to trial. We are not independently arguing that this court should reverse the order and remand for a new hearing with an attorney. Our position is that he is competent to waive counsel, which is what he did, and that he's also competent then to proceed to trial either without an attorney, because it's clear that he's competent to represent himself after, you know, what the record establishes as far as how competent he was to question witnesses, make his arguments. There was no indication that he wasn't competent at that point. So we are not arguing that there was any sort of structural error related to his waiver of counsel.
Mr. Erickson, can I follow up with that? In order for your client to win, quote unquote, it means therefore that as a reviewing court, we would independently disregard five experts who have indicated that your client is not competent to proceed. I'll go on a limb and suggest that might be a tall order for your client to succeed in. It seems like it's tough enough when you have two opinions that are competing, and even then we would defer typically to the credibility of the findings of a judge as to two opinions that went two different ways. But here you've got five who have all opined and accurately identified the test for competency to proceed to trial. So my question is, it would seem, therefore, the only likely method by which your client could win is the remedy you're not seeking, which is a remand for appointment of counsel your client does not want. Can you, if I'm misapprehending the process by which we would get to where you want, please feel free to identify that for me.
Yeah, Your Honor, I have two responses. The first is that all of the reports that were conducted prior to Mr. Thompson waiving his validly and competently waiving his right to counsel and then proceeding at the competency hearing pro se. So none of those evaluators considered whether his ability to competently represent himself therefore resulted in him being able to represent himself at trial. Second, I think it's really important to look through the examiner's findings as well as the court's order and try to find where there's actually a connection between his mental illness and being unable to rationally consult with his attorneys. It's clear that the examiners found mental illness, but that's not the standard for competency to proceed to trial. We know that he understood the legal proceedings. He did a great job in the courtroom. He was respectful to everybody in the courtroom, and he knew what was going on. The only question that the examiners raised was whether he was able to rationally consult with his attorneys. And I think the record establishes the opposite, that he certainly did. They had disagreements regarding what defense to present at trial. He wanted to present an entrapment defense, and his attorneys wanted to present potentially some other defense. And I think it's also important to note that his attorneys never filed a request for a Rule 20. His attorneys never stated that he was not competent to proceed to trial, and his attorneys never stated that he was unable to rationally consult with them. They did indicate that they had a trouble communicating, and they disagreed, but that's not the standard. And I think if that was the standard, we'd have a lot of criminal defendants being unable to proceed to trial because there's often disagreements with their attorneys regarding what to do, what strategy to pursue going forward to trial.
So when I read 2001 subdivision 2, which is where the judge talked about rationally consult with the attorney and participate in the defense. I think it's the rationally part that the judge found he couldn't do.
That's correct. Yep. So whether or not he could rationally consult with his attorneys. And our position is that the record does not establish that he could not rationally consult with his attorneys. There was only evidence that there was disagreement regarding trial strategy and nothing more than that. Again, his attorneys weren't the one. We often see defense attorneys, especially public defenders, filing Rule 20 requests. We didn't get to have that in this case. His attorneys didn't state at any time that they were unable to rationally consult with Mr. Thompson. And that's the only issue before this court is whether the state established that element. And again, if you read through the examiner's reports, there's no connection between his mental illness, his delusions, and whether or not he could actually rationally consult with his attorneys.
So your response to Judge Bryant's question about whether or not this is structural error is that it's not.
Well, we're requesting that this court basically do a sufficiency of the evidence review. We're not alleging any independent error outside of the state failing. You know, we can discuss the burden issue, but whether there was enough evidence to establish that Mr. Thompson was not competent to proceed to trial.
What do you have to say about the burden issue?
Well, you know, as we've discussed the other issues, I think this case is, we're kind of in uncharted waters here. There aren't any other cases that I could find where a defendant has appealed a finding of being not competent. I think the rule is set up for the opposite situation where a defendant is trying to prove that he is not competent. So, you know, I understand the plain language of the rule, but if we take a step back and think about what's happening here, is Mr. Thompson has a constitutional right to have a trial. And prior to a hearing or a finding of not competence, there aren't any findings saying that he's not competent to proceed to trial. Therefore, if the burden is on him to prove his competence, he basically has the burden to establish that he can have a trial without any evidence saying otherwise. Our position is that is unconstitutional. Mr. Thompson raised that argument below. And our position is that despite the rule and what the rule states, putting the burden on him to prove that he can exercise his right to trial is unconstitutional.
Mr. Erickson, I'm going to bring you back to the five experts. What is the legal definition such that it would match the factual record so that we could then review whether there's a sufficiency of how an individual in your client's position may rationally consult with counsel? In other words, what is the definition of irrational so we can look at it and see that the experts either got it right and therefore the judge did, or the experts got it wrong and therefore the judge did not?
Well, I don't have a specific definition for irrational consultation with an attorney. I do have to say that, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to clarify. I use that phrase because I assume in effect, that's what the doctors all opined. It was not rational, therefore it was irrational. And so I assumed if we had a definition of one or the other, it would help us to review the sufficiency issue that you're asking us to do.
Yeah, I don't have a definition, but again, I don't think the doctors or the examiners opined one way or the other regarding rationally consulting by pointing to any sort of evidence. I think that's our position is that while there was absolutely evidence of mental illness, there's nothing in the record that establishes any more than a disagreement. And I guess a disagreement is still rationally consulting.
But didn't they make findings that he had paranoia beliefs and opinions, whether it be about defense counsel, about prosecution, about the judge? Wouldn't that in and of itself be sufficient to find and therefore conclude that he cannot rationally consult with his attorney?
I don't think so for a couple of reasons, Your Honor. First, I think that's a bit of a stretch. I think there are a lot of criminal defendants who believe that the system is rigged against them, and that might not absolutely, you know, be a symptom of paranoia to the extreme where he can't rationally consult. with all due respect, lots of clients don't believe defense attorneys are advocating for them, or that judges are hearing their arguments, or that prosecutors are doing their jobs. So unless there was more than that, that his attorneys could testify to or opine to say, look, you know, he is not able to talk about anything with us. We can't have any sort of conversation about anything that's going to take place in the courtroom. I think it has to be a high bar. I mean, look, he's charged with second degree murder and he can't have his trial based solely on experts stating that because he disagrees with his attorneys, therefore he can't have a trial. And again, if I could just conclude that, you know, the second part of my argument is that his performance at his trial or at the competency hearing also establishes that he was able to rationally consult with the judge, with the prosecutor, with all of the witnesses, and make very articulate arguments. So I think that also supports our position that he would be able to rationally consult with his attorneys. I can wait to respond in rebuttal.
Any questions from Judges Brian or Sleater before we turn to respondent? Thank you. Respondent?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Karen McGillick. I'm an Assistant Attorney General appearing on behalf of the state of Minnesota. Obviously, in this case, we have several issues involving the standard of review, the burden of proof, and then ultimately whether the district court's decision should be reversed. The district court here relied on the expert opinions of five different psychologists who had performed seven separate examinations of the defendant over the course of a two-year period. Each of those, each of those examinations concluding that the defendant is incompetent to stand trial because he is unable to rationally consult with his attorneys. I heard defense counsel, you know, appellant counsel saying that there's nothing in the record to establish more than a mere disagreement with counsel about trial strategy. But when we review the actual examinations of the experts and the findings that they made, it is clear that the evidence in this case went well beyond a mere disagreement over trial strategy. The issue in this case is that the experts, the people that understand this type of mental illness, are able to look at the standards for competency to proceed to trial and were able to say in this case that his delusional disorder, his persecutory delusions, were causing him to have an inability to rationally consult about his case, because his entire defense wanted to be based on his irrational and delusional views about things that aren't real, about the case, about the attorneys involved, about the judge, and that he was so preoccupied with these delusions that he was unable to rationally plan for this trial.
Ms. McGillick, so, thank you for that. That dovetailed, I think, from the question I just asked Mr. Erickson. And I suspect this, the record speaks for itself, but that being the case, Ms. McGillick, I'm directing you to subdivision one of rule 2001, a defendant must not be allowed to waive counsel if the defendant lacks ability to. And if you look to F, comprehend any other matters essential to understanding the case. You seem to have just identified that broad category. How could we say the record supports his ability to comprehend any other matters related to the case when he has delusional thoughts about the prosecutor, the defense attorney, the judge, the entire process? Wouldn't that in and of itself be sufficient for us to conclude it was error to allow? And I'm not faulting the judge in the sense that perhaps that didn't come out until reviewing all the expert, but nevertheless, we're reviewing the entire case. That would strike me as a violation of subdivision 1F and a remand with counsel being appointed.
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree for several reasons. First of all, the appellant's position has never been that he shouldn't have been allowed to represent himself at the competency hearing. So that really wasn't the issue that was presented for this appeal. That aside, it's very important to keep in mind that in this case, the district court was not making a competency determination at the beginning of the hearing that he was competent to proceed trial. The judge was in a tough spot with a defendant who is coming into it, like, and as you know, appellant's counsel said, this is a very backwards case. Normally, we're not coming into a hearing where the state is conceding that the person is incompetent, and it's only the defendant pro se wanting to maintain that he is against the expert's opinions. So, what we had here was a judge trying to weigh out his ability to represent himself at the competency hearing, not at trial, not to proceed to trial. This was a preliminary determination for purposes of the competency hearing only, and not a final determination. At the point that the judge made the decision that he can represent himself at the hearing, it isn't based on all of the evidence that is subsequently going to come in at the hearing about his competence. That is the evidence that the judge weighed and ultimately made a final competency decision and determined that he was incompetent. At the beginning of the hearing, the judge is looking at the Rule 20 language about whether or not he has, you know, expressed a desire to represent himself. Does he understand the purpose of the hearing? Do the doctors believe he's intelligent enough and able to follow courtroom procedures? These are the things that Rule 20 outlines in terms of the standards. And the judge considered all of that, both at the beginning of the hearing and made oral findings on the record and in her order to determine that purposes of the competency hearing, with the assistance of standby counsel to assist him, this defendant was able to comply and proceed to this part of the proceeding. Now, beyond that, in order to meet the standard under Gomez, for example, you have to be able to meet both pieces, both prongs. You have to show that this person is competent to then proceed to trial. Gomez didn't address the situation of can a defendant represent himself at a competency hearing when he's maintaining he's competent.
Ms. McGillicuddy, I'm sorry, finish your thought, and then I just wanted to follow up if you...
Go ahead. Well, Zoom makes it awkward. I apologize.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yes. What I wanted to ask you then to follow up with that, essentially, since we know the standard is the same constitutionally, and Mr. Erickson makes a good point, then if we are looking now at all of the conduct, and indeed he conducted himself quite well intellectually and rationally in discussing the matter, and the judge so found at the beginning in waiving counsel, then why would we not reverse the other way and simply say it was error, conclusion of law, that he was not competent, and remand for trial?
And my response to that is twofold. Again, that wasn't the issue that was raised by appellant. They have never claimed that it was a structural error, any other type of error for him to be allowed to represent himself. And there's no case law that says that a defendant is automatically disqualified from representing himself at a competency hearing. In fact, in other states, that has happened where people have been allowed with standby counsel. And I, you know, again, it's difficult because Minnesota hasn't addressed this issue, so it made it hard to cite authority in my brief.
I'm sorry, Ms. McGill, but my point being, though, is the appellant certainly has raised from the beginning he's competent to proceed, so that issue would be directly before us. And if Mr. Erickson's asking, look at the findings, and you're agreeing the findings support that he intelligently waived, it seems to me that one conclusion we could draw from that is that therefore it was error for the court to conclude based on the evidence at the trial that he could not rationally consult with counsel, because he rationally consulted with everyone that he consulted with, perhaps even advisory counsel.
And again, there's several reasons. Number one, the Gomez standard. Essentially, what Gomez found is if you're competent to stand trial, you're also competent to waive counsel. Gomez did not say the opposite, which is that if you're competent to represent yourself at the competency hearing, you're automatically competent to waive your right and to proceed to trial and represent yourself. That is not what Gomez says.
But so how Gomez do we ignore that the test is the same? How do we ignore, though, and Camacho confirms that the test is the same? If it's the same, wouldn't it be the same either direction?
It would be the same if we were looking at whether or not he is competent to stand trial. This, again, Gomez didn't address the situation of a person's competency to waive counsel for a competency hearing.
Right, Ms. McGillicuddy, let me jump in here, because this is the part where I think I might disagree with you a little bit. What authority is there that we've ever treated the right to have counsel at one hearing differently from the right to have counsel at a different hearing? Is there any authority that says that you have to repeatedly waive your right to counsel? If you don't want to have counsel at an arraignment, if you don't want to have counsel at a bail hearing, that is a constitutional right. And if you waive it at the bail hearing, what authority is there that you have to repeatedly waive it at every other hearing in the case? Don't you either have it or you don't? And once you've given it up, that's it. You have a right for the entire criminal proceeding, unless you can point me to some authority that says there's one constitutional right to counsel at arraignment, one constitutional right to counsel at an omnibus, one constitutional right to counsel at a competency hearing, then how can we without that authority make the distinctions you're asking us to make?
I believe the authority comes from the rule itself, which requires the district court, when there's reason to have the competency in question, to analyze the issue and make a new determination at whatever point the facts change. So again, we're not looking at these cases that talk about competency to stand trial or to waive right for trial. We're looking at this very narrow issue, and the judge was very clear in her order. I am only determining this for purposes of this hearing only. So the judge is looking at the information she has at the beginning of the hearing, which is his ability to meet the criteria. Rule 20 explicitly gives the judge authority to allow a person to waive their right to counsel for competency hearing.
Let me ask about that a little bit too, because the beginning of Rule 20 sub 1 says lacks ability to. And so the question becomes, what is the standard that we apply to determine if someone lacks the ability to do A through F? And isn't that the competency standard that's articulated in case law, Godinez, Camacho, Thornblatt? How do you know if someone lacks ability? Well, you have two-part tests to determine if they lack ability to do any of the A through F things.
You know, as I read the rule, what it's basically saying is that you can waive your right to counsel in competency proceedings if you show A through F, which based on the evidence that was in front of the judge at the time she made the decision at the beginning of the competency hearing, before the experts all testified, before their reports came into evidence, based on following just A through F in the rule, which gives her explicit authority to allow him to waive it for a competency proceeding, separate from waiving it for trial or separate from a final determination of whether he is competent to proceed to trial, the judge was within her right to examine the rule that gave her the authority to allow him to waive.
My question is, under that rule, I don't think you're hearing my question right. Under that rule, we have to have some way of determining whether someone has the ability to do A through F or not. And isn't that determination, do you lack the ability? Isn't that the piece that requires the competency test that is articulated in lots of cases, but referenced in Godinez and Thornblatt and Camacho?
And again, I think this is where it becomes very circular, is that if we're saying that the judge has to make an entire competency determination at the beginning of a competency hearing, it's essentially making a rule that would say no defendant would ever be allowed to represent himself in a competency hearing where he's claiming he's competent. So then the judge on the front end would have to do a full hearing to decide the competency before deciding whether they can represent themselves at competency hearing. And it puts the judge in an impossible position, because let's say that the evidence came out and he's competent, and now he's been denied the right to self-representation at the beginning of the hearing, even though at the beginning of the hearing he was maintaining he's competent. I think it puts the judge in a catch-22, somewhat, which was discussed in the literature, about what are you supposed to do in this situation. The judge has to make a final determination about his competency to proceed to trial based on case law about competency to proceed to trial at the end of the hearing. But at the beginning of the hearing, I think the only thing she can do is make findings based on what she has in front of her, which is him standing up at trial, saying that standing at the beginning of the hearing, indicating that he understands the purpose of the hearing, understands that the purpose is not a trial, but to understand whether he's competent. And again, the purpose of the competency hearing is for the judge to try to figure out if he's ready to proceed to trial. So giving him an opportunity to represent himself and show what he can and can't do and what he understands and how he behaves in court and in that proceeding, in that narrow proceeding, is different than allowing him to proceed to be tried for murder and potentially go to prison. So
Ms. McGillic, I think the judge is being... I'm sorry. You hit on something I wanted to ask you about, and that is it strikes me as an incongruous, which is part of our challenge here today. And the judges, I agree. The interesting thing then, I understand the process, it's not so hypothetical. The judge sua sponte brought up the issue of Rule 20. And obviously appellants never wanted one. The state actually opposed the first one. So we have a not so hypothetical situation by your client's position that if the judge had not sua sponte raised it, that the appellant, who we now know by looking at five examination was not competent to proceed to trial, would have proceeded to trial and represented himself because by that analysis was sufficient to waive counsel. Is that your understanding of what could have happened essentially? So we know retroactively, and again, somewhat hypothetically, that unconstitutionally he would have gone through a trial having waived counsel. because no competency, no evaluations would have said otherwise, but we know there are five that have.
I mean, certainly the issue had to be raised by someone in order for us to get into the Rule 20 proceedings. And so, there, you know, not only that's how we got here. The state's position is limited solely to competency proceedings. I'm not saying that because a defendant stands up and says that they can represent himself, that automatically means the defendant should be allowed to proceed to trial. Obviously, if there is a reason for further inquiry under Rule 20, the judge and the prosecutor and the defense attorney all have an obligation to bring that forward and to get expert opinions and to decide whether or not this person is competent before proceeding any further. Again, my argument is limited solely to his ability to represent himself at the competency hearing only. And the thing is, he did do a pretty good job at the competency hearing, but he also espoused a lot of his delusional beliefs at the competency hearing. And that was part of the judge's decision, is that even at the competency hearing, he's continuing to be delusional.
I know I keep interrupting because there's not much time.
That's okay.
I don't have a chance to jump in. I feel like there's no pausing in the answer. So sorry to interrupt. And I know you want to wrap up. Let me throw out this question and then I think there'll be some time for you to finish your thought there. Would it have been different if an attorney had represented him at the competency? Would
Absolutely
the record be
not.
Different?
Absolutely not. And that's where we get into this clear error review. We have five experts who all agree that this person is incompetent. And at the hearing itself, the defendant showed that his delusional beliefs were still very much present and part of his strategy. Those were the things that the judge relied on in ultimately deciding that he does not meet the double pronged standard to proceed to trial because he is incompetent at this point in time. So no, there would have been no difference in the outcome based on the evidence that was produced at the hearing. And I see that my time has expired, and I'm also sorry for the talking over. Zoom does make this a little more challenging, but the state would ask that the district court's order be upheld. There's ample evidence to support the decision that was made. There is no reason to reverse on the issue of whether he should have represented himself, since that isn't even an issue that was raised in this case. Thank you very much.
This is a really important case and interesting. I think you both would agree that procedurally, it's been very hard to find other cases where the procedure and the facts are similar. So Judges Brian and Sleater, do you have any more questions before we turn for rebuttal? Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Erickson.
Thank you. A couple points. First, I just want to make clear that our position isn't that if a defendant is allowed to waive his right to counsel at the competency hearing, then he's guaranteed the right to represent himself at trial. If Mr. Thompson would have waived the right to counsel, had the competency hearing, and did a terrible job, and the evidence established that he was not competent to represent himself at the hearing, then there would be no issue. The judge could say, you are not competent to proceed pro se. You're not competent to proceed with an attorney. We're going to suspend the proceedings. So this isn't an automatic situation. In this case, it's very rare that Mr. Thompson did an extraordinary job at the hearing. He proved during the hearing by how he represented himself that he was competent to proceed to trial. So if there was any doubt regarding whether he was competent to waive counsel, that doubt went away during the hearing when he did such a good job. I also think it's important to note that this is also an interesting case because the judge had previously reviewed all of the reports prior to remand and found Mr. Thompson not competent to stand trial. Then the judge found he was competent to proceed pro se. So it's not a situation where the judge had no information before her before making that determination regarding a waiver. If there's a situation where a Rule 20 is filed, the judge hasn't reviewed any of the evidence. Defendant says, I want to waive counsel. Judge says, I have no reason to doubt you're not competent. You can proceed pro se. Then the evidence comes in at the hearing and the judge says, whoa, you are not competent. That's a completely different situation than what happened here because the judge had already reviewed all the evidence and had found him not competent to stand trial before the hearing took place.
Mr. Erickson, just to clarify, are you indicating, and I listen to the point that perhaps both of you have made, that since your client has not raised the issue of lack of appointment of counsel, that we, even though your client has asked us to review the entire proceeding, essentially as a sufficiency of evidence, that we would necessarily ignore that issue? In other words, even if we find there was error under subdivision 1F for the court to have allowed him to proceed without counsel, that we would ignore that and just look at the, and yet just look at the facts related to the issue of Rule 20, the competency only.
Well, again, our position is that Mr. Thompson was competent to waive counsel and competent to stand trial. I don't know what discretion this court has on its own to review a constitutional issue of a waiver of counsel, but our position is only that he was competent to stand trial because he was competent to waive counsel. So I don't know if you can do that independently or not, but that's not our position.
Mr. Erickson, if I could get back to the question I asked at the beginning, I think I know kind of what the answer is, but I still want to hear your response. Did the district court apply the test for competency that's articulated in Godinez when it determined Mr. Thompson was competent to waive counsel?
The record does not reflect that the judge did not go through the rule. There's not a record of it.
I'm not talking about the rule. I'm talking about the two-part stand. In other words, I'll be very precise.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
It seems to me Godinez requires the district court to look at a person's rational ability to consult with counsel in determining competency to waive counsel. So the question then is, did the district court consider that basis when it deemed Mr. Thompson competent to waive counsel, the very basis that it relies on to say he's not competent to stand trial? Did the district court consider that in determining competency to waive counsel at the competency hearing?
Yes. The court considered whether Mr. Thompson communicated with his advisory counsel regarding his right to proceed pro se. So the judge considered that factor of whether there was communication regarding the right. And I think at that point,
where in the court's order or in the transcript does the court apply that part of the test?
Of talking to the advisory counsel?
Rationally able to consult with counsel.
The court did not use that language when finding that Mr. Thompson was competent to proceed. I'll give you that. But the court did consider whether or not he discussed waiving counsel and proceeding pro se with advisory counsel. I don't think that's our burden to establish that the court, when that's not the issue before us, the court found he is competent to proceed to trial or to proceed pro se at the competency hearing. I don't think it's our burden to now establish that that was how the court got there when the court didn't make perhaps a sufficient record.
But your position is the court did in fact apply that part of the test when it determined he's competent to waive counsel, the same part of the test that it applied to determine him incompetent to stand trial.
Yes, our position is that in order for the judge to allow Mr. Thompson to waive counsel, the court had to make that finding. And the court found that he was validly waived his right to counsel. The court made that finding. So I think we have to assume that the judge understood the rule, understood the constitutional issue at stake, and made those findings. There is not a record of it, but again, the court found that he validly waived the right to counsel.
Judge Riley, could I ask one follow-up question, please?
Please.
Mr. Erickson, just to clarify, part of our unique nature here of this case is that at the beginning of this hearing, the judge indeed had two prior Rule 20 evaluations finding your client not competent. Correct?
That's correct. I believe it was two, yes.
And is it my understanding correct that in both of those, the basis under Rule 20, subdivision two, is the same, failure or unable to rationally consult with counsel. So the judge actually had those opinions at the beginning of this proceeding.
That's right. The judge had, I believe every one of the examiners concluded only that he was unable to rationally consult with an attorney. And the judge had those prior to the first competency order and the second one, but then also found that Mr. Thompson could waive his right to counsel.
Go ahead, Judge Riley.
I was just going to ask about subdivision 1F, comprehend any other matters essential to understanding the case. It's your position that the record supports the judge's finding there?
Yeah, and I think that's kind of what Judge Brian was getting at earlier. And our position is that in order for Mr. Thompson to proceed pro se, the judge had to make that finding under the rule. And I think we can presume that the judge made that finding because the judge found that he validly waived his right to counsel.
Judge Sleater?
Well, yes, thank you. I'm trying to have a hard time understanding, Mr. Erickson. We know, of course, individuals, as you point out, many times don't like their, usually it's the public defender and so forth. But if the result isn't good, they don't like their attorney at all. But would it be safe to say that an important matter in understanding the case is understanding that the defense attorney works only for you and is trained and experienced and understands the law better than your client? At least I'm making a presumption here. So when there's paranoia, there's in the record evidence of paranoia thoughts about the attorney who's representing yourself. Couldn't we objectively say as a matter of law, that's not understanding something about that's important in the case? And one might still waive, and we see that all the time. And that's why you make sure to talk about penalties and you'll be subject to the same rules. But looking at those sorts of pretty strong opinions in the Rule 20 examination suggests that's an important part of the case. One needs to be inquired upon, at least by the judge, and perhaps an acknowledgement. And then if there's an acknowledgement, now there's an understanding about it that, yeah, I take a risk that I'm not going to do as well as my attorney would, but I'm willing to take that risk and proceed.
I think generally your question is, you know, whether someone who's paranoid and disagrees with their attorney can waive the right to counsel, and whether that alone would establish an invalid waiver. And I think there just has to be more on the record regarding that connection, regarding any sort of mistrust of his own attorneys.
Maybe I can be a little more precise. An understanding that, for instance, the prosecutor isn't able to subliminally send messages to a judge, and the judge is independent from the prosecutor, and the defense attorney represents only me, and those sorts of things. It seems like the record is filled with concerns, which, of course, led to the conclusion of incompetency. Wouldn't those be important matters to understand about the case under F?
Well, I think every expert concluded that he understand the proceedings and he understood who, you know, for that first, that other prong of the test of rationally understanding the proceedings, he needs to understand who the prosecutor is, what the prosecutor's role is, what the judge's role, what his attorney's role is. So that's established. There's never been any debate about whether he understood those things. The question of whether or not he believed that, you know, his attorney was working against him, I see that all the time. And I just don't believe that gets to the conclusion of not being able to rationally consult when there is so much evidence that he is very, very competent to rationally consult with every single person in the courtroom. So I understand your concern, but I don't feel like there's enough here in this case, especially when there's so much evidence that he understands what takes place in the courtroom, which is the biggest question of competency, especially for somebody who wants to proceed pro se.
And the only reason I was distinguishing, I understand what you're getting at, but of course that's why F appears only in Rule 20 and in a competency proceeding. And it seems to mirror our statutes on civil commitment where one cannot waive counsel. The court shall appoint. Both our rules and the commitment statute all reference appointing counsel. And this F seems to add sort of a catch-all. That's part of why I was inquiring as to that. It seems to be distinct from the usual that I don't like my public defender.
I do. I agree. And if I could just, I know we're going beyond the time here, but I do think that this test is more stringent than the regular waiver of counsel test in that it does require that. And I don't think there's, again, I'll repeat myself over and over again, but I don't think there's any better evidence that he was understood what was going on than how he represented himself at the hearing. And then again, his attorneys never indicated otherwise, and they're the ones who had the most information, and they didn't testify at his hearing. So if there aren't any other questions, we request that this court reverse the competency order and remand so Mr. Thompson can exercise his constitutional right to a trial.
Thank you. You can tell that this case, we've put a lot of thought into it already, and thank you for your arguments and your briefing, and we'll get our opinion out within the 90 days. Thank you.